what is it, 13 January 1980. So, in answer to that question...
There were lapses on the part of the greatest of the people interested, Enrico Fermi, quite clearly. The mechanism, in fact, is not valid. Particles are not accelerated in space, but presumably in the shells of supernovae. But in any case, we didn't leap to the right conclusion. And a year later, astronomical evidence came that there were, in fact, magnetic fields in our own galaxy, and that they were pretty strong fields, in fact, of the same order of magnitude as Fermi had required for the origin of cosmic rays. And
this was Hiltner and Hall's work.
Right. Observation which was done because Chandrasekhar had suggested that certain kinds of B stars of high temperature should have linearly polarized light produced by an anisotropy of the electron scattered radiation.
I see.
Hiltner looked for it and found it, but he found that the direction of the polarization was essentially the same in several hot B stars he looked at. And then he looked at more, and he found more or less regularities, and he found it in other than very hot B stars. Hall did a more precise observation and carried it over a good fraction of the sky. John Hall, who was then at the U.S. Naval Observatory, way off his normal activities, had really the first mapping of the interstellar polarization, and the explanation of it, we felt, required the existence of a much stronger magnetic field, really, than one now imagines to exist, perhaps 10 times stronger. We being, in this case, Leverett Davis, a physicist at Caltech, and myself. And we published several papers, including, I think, finally, an enormous difficult thing in 1951 on the theory of interstellar polarization and its interpretation.
Let me get back to the radio astronomy track. Can you tell me, once again, not being able to interview Botta or Minkowski, I did talk to Minkowski, but it was of limited use. Can you tell me about their characters and what it was, as you see it, that got them interested in these radio sources?
Well, the easiest thing to say about them, and I think it's fair, is that they were, for older people, and they were not young when they started, the most open-minded, least bound by convention and conventional wisdom, and everybody knows that, and it is generally assumed that I've ever met. They're Botta, well, I think it's 58, did I say, or 61, and Minkowski 58 in the crucial year of the 51-52 paper, or 52-53 paper, or whatever. And yet they were like children, and part of this came from the fact that neither of them, in their whole life, had ever been bound by responsibilities for organizing anything. They could think and did think about science at their speed and with no interest or fear of competition, incidentally. Next, they were the major users of the 100-inch telescope during World War II. Botta was an enemy alien, limited in travel, but was allowed to go up Mount Wilson. The city was blacked out, and so the remarkably work he did, which resulted in the discovery of the so-called two major populations, and the solution of the problem of the difference, the Cepheids and the breakup of the log jam on the distance scale for the Hubble expansion, all came because Botta was just an absolutely superb technician and used big telescopes when he needed to. They were the head of what was called, I don't know which physically was called head, but they talked all the time, collaborated. They shared out the dark sky observing time. And both of them were quite conventional physics educated, probably neither of them knew quantum mechanics. But none of this bothered them because they could look at what was in the sky. As people, they were just as warm and marvelous human beings as I can remember. One of the reasons I came to Caltech was to be near them. I had visited a year before, just for a month or so, and had such fun talking to them. And the tragedies are, of course, that they both knew very much more than they ever published. Botta kept absolutely no letter files. Minkowski's desk was a foot high with letters rotted from exposure to California air for 5 or 10 years. The claim was, and I think it was partly true, that he knew where every letter was. They carried their correspondence out often in longhand. And the early, soon after retirement of Botta and his decision to return to Germany was a disaster because he took all his papers with him.
And this was what time when he returned?
Three or four years after those papers, that big paper.
So that was 54, it was published.
Yeah, 57.
Okay.
He went back to Germany.
He took all those papers with him, and then what do you know about them?
To my knowledge, Walter Botta's wife, named Mushi, was very jealous of him and his recognition, and held on to them, and a strong attempt, whose outcome I don't know, was made by Jan Oort, who, living in the Netherlands, was not far from where the widowed Mrs. Botta lived. Jan Oort wanted desperately for history and science to get those things. And I think it went negative, and I don't know what happened. And the only person who would know, I guess, is Oort, or maybe van der Hulst would know what happened. But we discussed it in later visits when Oort, who often came to Pasadena, talked about it, and I don't know the outcome. They never came back here. Minkowski carried things to Berkeley, and if anybody has any of Minkowski's paper or private handwritten notes from Walter Botta about this or that, it would be the Berkeley department.
Well, I have gone through a lot of Minkowski's papers at Berkeley. Yeah. No, they are there.
Are there any letters from Botta? Are there any memos?
Only a very few. It's mostly correspondence. Of course, I was looking only at the radio astronomy stuff with Mills and Bolton. And,
well, it's funny. Maybe they were so free because they had no responsibility, and historically this has been a disaster because there are no papers.
So what you're saying, it sounds like, is that their interest in radio astronomy was largely because simply they would go towards any new exciting thing. It wasn't particularly that they, there were many other instances of such things.
Well, they had a very fine, shall we say, batting record on going for new things, one of which is supernovae.
Right.
And in a certain sense, while we didn't really know, everybody had a feeling that I can remember when we talked, and we talked incessantly of these topics at lunches and in the evening, socially, that they must have something to do with each other, that the violence of the supernova must have something to do with radio bursts, say, in the sun, which were known by then. But it really is, the trouble was that Botta had everything in his head and in handwritten materials, and had a real constitutional aversion to writing papers. It comes from being a great observant technician with a very eclectic view of astronomy. He was a walking encyclopedia of facts about strange objects, about strange variables. And when he did this separation into the different populations, he had to know that there were certain kinds of long-period variables with periods from 100 to 150 days that had completely different space motion properties than the others. That group
right.
belonged to the halo. And then there were these strange so-called, well, looked like double period Cepheids, called W Virginis stars. Mm-hmm. And they too had different space motions. Well, he was a classical astronomer, so space motions was something he would know. But that he had this kind of mind in which every fact about every kind of strange variable star was pigeonholed somewhere, and that this would somehow, when he resolved the nearby galaxies and the local group into the two populations, one with no very bright stars, but with variables which belong to population two, the other the spiral envelope. He knew all the things then that would belong to the population. In fact, much of our lunch conversations didn't have anything to do with radio astronomy, was did I know any other stars or any other properties of stars that were correlated with these population types? Mm-hmm. And Alan Sandage was one of the pioneers in noticing the extreme low metal abundance in the population two field stars, not another galaxy. I think this freedom, which you can't imagine in contemporary science, to know everything, to read everything, and to remember it, which is genius, not freedom, and to put it together, was how radio astronomy could appeal to them. Mm-hmm. Most naturally, I think the direct impact was through the Crab Nebula, which is behind everything, it seems, in high-energy astrophysics. But
well, now, the first that I know of them is in 1951, when Graham Smith gave them some very good positions of the bright radio sources. Do you specifically remember that they were thinking about radio astronomy in a serious sense before then?
Yes, I think they were thinking and talking of it from the time I got there.
But not actually doing any observations, because you didn't know where to look.
That's right, there wasn't much to do. I'm just briefly seeing if I can hold it. Baden Minkowski, who have to be treated as a pair because of the lack of a record of what individually they did, were interested in anything new to which optical observations, and they were then the only observations and largely photographic, with large telescopes could make a contribution. And as I said, in spite of age, they were open-minded. The Crab Nebula had been an intriguing subject, and I think Minkowski's first paper was 1942 on the Crab. It was unfortunately had some theoretical errors in it, and so he and I collaborated on it, and by this time photography had revealed that there were really two components, the so-called amorphous mass with a continuous spectrum, and that's what Minkowski had tried to explain and which I tried to explain. And if one reads that paper, as I did recently, and looked back at the paper on the spectra of the supernovae, which Botta and Minkowski, or I think they wrote separate papers in the paper together, but Minkowski had done the spectroscopic work, you can see that in a certain sense some of the problems of the supernova spectrum are even reflected in the way we redid the idea of the emission from a very hot plasma. Mm-hmm. In the paper he and I wrote. And that paper, of course, was way off the ball, and since nobody had made the link to the synchrotron emission, it was just wasted wind, in fact.
Well, but you realize that, I mean, here in the abstract, that the thermal emission is only about 1% of the observed radial flux.
Right. We couldn't do it. But we couldn't, Whipple and I couldn't do it in 1937, so we hadn't come very far. What counts is what succeeds, not why you fail. There's no point in explaining it away.
Well, a historian of science has a somewhat different attitude.
There is another thing, by the way, that you have to know in between, which is relevant to my lapse of memory. Because of the Korean War, I went into military research. And I more or less vanished for a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
And this was connected with what eventually sunk J. Robert Oppenheimer, a thing called Project Vista, mm-hmm. which is on the arguments for nuclear atomic weapons for use in tactical situations and against strategic bombing. And I have here my humorous map of the Great Seal of Project Vista. In ulceribus victorious, academia destructa milites disgustibus. Meaning...
A loose translation.
In loose translations, victorious in ulcers, the academy or the universities destroyed, and the soldiers disgusted. And it consists of a battleship, a missile, a machine gun, eyeglasses, that's academic, mm-hmm. bombs being dropped, and bottles with a fizzing glass near it representing what we did.
So I gather you were rather disgusted with the whole...
Well, it was a very traumatic period. I was out for roughly a year, full time, and very heavily involved in it. And it got me a certificate by Robert Lovett, Secretary of Defense, and a personal letter from Frank Pace, Secretary of the Army, dated 1952. And so in this critical year, 51-52, I wasn't even at most of the lunches. On the other hand, I was still trying to be a scientist and run the department. So I don't honestly know the details, except this, that the radio astronomers did, in fact, turn to BARTA, really, for photography of interesting fields.
Right.
And if BARTA found anything strange, Rudolph did the spectroscopy. And nobody else, because by this time, the completion of the 200-inch, which had really gone up the mountain in 48, but really wasn't used much till 51, the completion of the 200-inch and of a special spectrograph for very faint objects had made it possible for the two of them to do the best they could. So if you wish, with a critical burst of mm-hmm. new information when it was needed.
Well, moving on with your connection with things, it looks like the next paper is indeed in 1954 about the energies and radio sources. It was one of the four papers in APJ. And of course, by this time, you had the identification with the supernova remnants, you had the Cygnus A identification, and Virgo A pinned down. So was the picture becoming a little clearer then?
Yeah, and if one looks at it, except one has to look at it with a little knowledge of a giant correction to be applied, we were still using, as late as 54, the so-called old distance scale, the expansion of the universe a la Hubble and Tolman, 540 kilometers a second per megaparsec.
Right.
True value being nearly, well, the order of 60 or 70, I think, now. We were still using it, but in all of those things, looking at the photograph, seeing the emitting volume, you found that even with the old distance scale, in which things were 10 times too close and therefore 100 times too faint, the volume emissivities, which is what we concentrated on, were just absolutely out of the question for anything. It
right.
corresponded to unbelievable temperatures, and we say so. And allowing for the fact that the things, if they're further away, also a bit larger, you don't lose that whole factor of 100, but there's a factor of 10, actually, in the net nature.
Right.
They're just much worse, even, than we knew. We didn't know where, let's say, the radio source was in, say, Virgo A. Was it in this tiny little thing, or was it in this giant elliptical galaxy? And so a consequence was that we put in too big a volume. Had we put in the correct thing, that it was from a very small central source, or in, Centaurus A, where the strongest things are two tiny little lobes near the middle, within which there's an even tinier VLBI source. I mean, when you look at that now, you can just say, good Lord, how can you have been so conservative? but we were talking down at what seemed to be rational limits, and we just say, as I remember it, that we just couldn't explain it, that we desperately needed another source of energy. And I can claim no credit because it hit us quite suddenly within, just really before that was published. Hoyle had been here, Hoyle and Fowler had talked. I forget what dates Burbage gave for the first things they wrote. You'd have to look that up. And we were just forgetting that people who had been talking to us had already told us that things were much worse than we thought.
Right.
In the Manchester IAU Radio Astronomy Symposium.
In 1955. Right, you gave a review talk there. I wanted to ask you about that. Right.
Yeah, it's still conservative. So I'm there's no, let's forget, the whole thing was a bloody shame. Hoyle's visit in 53, interestingly enough, I have it here, was a visiting professor, covered formation of the heavy elements and collapsing stars at high temperatures, that's supernovae, the theory of formation of galaxies, no mention of radio sources yet. And yet that same year, as I remember it.
But Hanbury Brown came through that same time, so you certainly were getting a radio astronomer's contact.
Oh, the personal contact, because of these meetings, especially the one in Australia, gave us the sort of link to the decision on what we were going to do at Caltech, because by then we more or less decided that the subject was too important to be left either to failures of theory or to radio engineers. And so we thought, given the strong links that I had forged with the physics group and nuclear astrophysics before Jeff Burbage was born, almost in 50 or 51, I learned nuclear physics from Fowler and we worked together. We just decided that it didn't matter whether it was astronomy or physics or something, we had to do something. And we met all these guys.
You said the meeting in Australia, are you talking about the IRSI?
Yeah,
when was that? 52.
52.
Did you go to that meeting?
No, I didn't, but the people came through here. I tended not to go to...
Well, I would have thought that very strange for you to be at an IRSI meeting at that time.
Well, oddly enough, I remember, I think by, at that time I was vice president of the IAU. No, not yet. There was a discussion of where they should publish things.
Yes.
And they were going to have their own journal.
Right.
And either in the early period as consular or later, I and others urged very strongly, and I think Chandrasekhar was quite favorably disposed, to the idea the Astrophysical Journal should be the home for radio astronomy, and later that the IAU, rather than IRSI, should be their official meeting place,
right,
if we were going to bring them in.
Right. Do you remember who was favoring a journal of radio astronomy?
I thought that was either the Australians or the British. Certainly wasn't the Americans. They could publish in the Proceedings of the Institute of Radio and Electronic Engineers,
right,
but that was such an enormous thing, you know, with really, it would never have had any impact.
Of course, but the British were always publishing monthly notices right from the very beginning.
Well, I think there was a strong move, and I thought it was British, but it may have been Australian, to create a journal for radio astronomy.
I haven't heard about this.
Yeah, there was. If it's mentioned anywhere, officially it would be in Dave Edge's book.
Right.
And I'd have to look there, but I remember definitely a real concern that we would lose this topic. And whatever it was part of astronomy, and certainly Chandrasekhar, I am absolutely certain, was quite excited and interested. Chandra was very critical of astronomers as being conservative, letting things sort of go by them, and he worked with distinguished physicists enough to know that great physicists were brighter than the best astronomers. But on the other hand, physicists didn't know how hard it is to get an astronomical fact straight.
Right. Well, so there was an editorial in APJ in around 56 or 57 emphasizing that radio astronomy papers are welcome.
Right. Then that dates it because then I was vice president of the AAS. And I'd left Yerkes, of course, and I had nothing to do with it, but I'm fairly sure the AAS had discussed this in the council meetings and so forth.
Okay, let's go back to 54 in this meeting, which apparently you were part of the organization of in Washington, D.C. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, we, as I said, felt that life was passing us by. We knew all these bright guys who kept coming and who kept writing letters to Minkowski after Bader retired, even. It wasn't so long. And there was internal discussion in the high administration of Caltech, which consisted of Lee Dubridge, ex-head of Radiation Lab, and Bob Bakker, head of physics, math, and astronomy, under whom I worked, about doing something serious in the way of radio astronomy. Now, Caltech claims that it never does anything unless it does things well. That claim could be investigated by a historian. It might not come out that way, but that's the claim.
That's the goal.
Yeah. And so there was this big argument whether astronomy should just swallow radio astronomy if it came. Next, if radio astronomy as a subject had a serious long-term future.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember that there was one line the radio astronomy could observe, the 21 centimeter line,
mm-hmm.
a few years old. These discussions were in fact going on. Radio astronomy 21 centimeter line was an important addition to the arguments pro, because a continuum all by itself isn't that much fun and you might exhaust it. And although the possibilities of interferometer for accurate location had suggested that you would have lots of sources if all you ever got was an energy distribution, and if you couldn't identify them all, which was, I think, already the situation, you'd never get a distance to them. You wouldn't know what they were until you eventually got, which just now exists, the one arc second or better.
Right.
Resolution and pointing accuracy. Then there's only one stellar image from the ground per radio astronomy picture element. Well, we had quite serious discussions. I was then a kind of, it was just a nominal position. I was head of the astronomy option. There's a very queer organizational setup which we had to resolve. Research at Caltech and Carnegie using Mount Wilson and Palomar is done in the name of the Mount Wilson Palomar, now Hale Observatories. And radio astronomy didn't fit in automatically unless Hale Observatories accepted it. Ike Bowen, who had been a physicist and identified the forbidden lines, very important in optics and astronomy, was not too happy about the idea of enlarging the wavelength range, mainly also because it meant such a new technology that the present staff, the staff they then had, might not have been all that suitable. And he was perhaps a little afraid of sort of diffusion of effort.
Right,
since,
right.
By the way, at that time, all work was privately supported by Caltech and Carnegie from endowment funds, or non-endowment in some cases, just out of capital. So a big expansion, a well-done expansion, might have sort of outweighed the rest of the observatory.
Right.
But on the other hand, we were quite free at Caltech to do whatever we liked. If it weren't in the Well, it was the Palomar Observatory set up, so we had to work out an organization, so we put it in the physics department, even for thinking. So it was then a question for Bacher as head of physics and astronomy, and me as head of astronomy, and DuBridge. And DuBridge had a personal, strong enthusiasm for it because of his experience in the radiation lab, and also because, fundamentally, of the personal contact he had with E.G. Bowen, head of CSIRO in Australia, a protagonist of radio astronomy. Bowen was a frequent visitor. He was no longer a working scientist like Henry Brown or Graham Smith. Graham Smith, by the way, was a visiting professor, I think, the year after Hoyle.
I see.
I don't have a list of all of them, but we...
I know that he spent a year at DTM. Around 54 or so, and you came here to Caltech for a while at that same time?
Yeah, maybe we shared them, and very likely that we shared the course then. And Peter Scheuer was another very early visitor. And in any case, we had radio astronomers as visitors. We had now this conclusively accepted theory, we're talking of 53, of the synchrotron source. And that put it right in high-energy physics.
Mm-hmm.
We had Hoyle coming on a regular basis, 3 months a year, I think, beginning in 52, sometimes to astronomy, sometimes to physics, later mostly to physics. And it just seemed a natural thing to do, but the interesting thing was that both Bacher and DuBridge wanted to be convinced. They really wanted to be convinced.
Yeah. Yeah.
That radio astronomy had a sort of infinite extension before they plunged in. So, being rather, you know, people accustomed to power and organizational responsibility, they decided that we're going to have a meeting and discuss it, a national meeting, and Carnegie Institution of Washington, Caltech, and the Science Foundation, essentially in equal role, sponsored this meeting in Washington, which was held in the Carnegie Institution headquarters in downtown Washington.
And I believe that was January 54.
January 54. And I was head of the organizing committee, and
this meeting, though, was to look at the whole U.S. role in radio astronomy.
Well, world. It's worldwide. If you've never seen the program, it's fairly impressive.
Well, but no, it covered the whole development,
yeah.
but was not the goal of it to say, all right, now what does the U.S. do?
Yeah, exactly. Right. There are two aspects of that. Should Caltech do it? Should the National Science Foundation think of something big in radio astronomy? And the resume, I guess, is here, December 31st, 53. Some 75 leading astronomers, radio astronomers, physicists, and electronics engineers have been invited to the conference from the United States, Canada, Australia, England, Netherlands. Among them is Professor H.C. van der Hulst, who will come to Caltech as visiting professor in astrophysics after the conference. Among the speakers from here were Lester Field, who became a vice president of Hughes Aircraft, now retired, Rudolf Minkowski, DuBridge, and myself.
So what happened to this meeting? What do you see the role of this meeting in the development of radio astronomy?
I view it as sort of seminal, but that's just because I found it one of the really good meetings that we've ever had. I don't like meetings, actually.
And why was it good? I mean, what was it about the meeting that...
It was genuinely... I'd say it represented the culmination over the world, reports on the culmination of the world of the World War II, an immediate post-war growth of radio astronomy, and it was really exciting. The By the way, I mentioned before that Merrill Tuve had wanted radio astronomy in Washington at Carnegie.
Right.
It would have been a natural thing rather than here in the Hale in the Mount Wilson Palomar observatories. Incidentally, Charlie Seeger was acting assistant director for mathematics, physics, and engineering sciences in the NSF at that year.
NSF, I see.
And so we were talking as much to each other, listening to the people from outside, and as we were talking to the NSF with the idea that there would be some funding started.
Well, if it had, of course, this is seminal for the growth of what became NRAO also.
Yes, yeah, that was
it. Was there not a possible conflict that a decision would be made there that, all right, NSF money should go to a national observatory, and then you at Caltech would be left to your own?
Shall we say that that is a long story? Sure. Sure. You can't have everything. If you're going to ask for... if you're going to ask for government money, you're not going to retain your freedom.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you're in on the ground floor, you at least have a fighting chance. And all of this led to terrible conflicts later about who would operate the National Radio Observatory. But at least I view it as seminal in that even if it led to the conflicts, conflicts eventually led to NRAO, which is outstanding success in government-supported research, in my opinion. One of the outstanding successes, like I view the National Accelerator Lab and the VLA as really great things. They really make a difference. Nobody knew who was going to ride the tiger, but we better at least get the tiger rolling. And I thought it was a great group because it is, in fact, a worldwide representation.
Oh, yes.
Except for the Russians. And I don't even remember whether we tried to get them, but we. I notice this is my working sheet. Al Vain was added. Kuiper didn't come. Let's see. Van Atto. He was people that I had really just met. Charlie Towns was then at Bell Telephone.
Right, I think he talked about possibilities of molecular spectroscopy.
Yeah, that was really, to me, the high point, incidentally.
Amazing paper, right?
Yeah. That
I'm still a little puzzled. Were you thinking then that NSF might want to go for a national observatory, but then that Caltech might be able to operate this for other people?
I have no idea whether... No, not Caltech, in any case, it would have been. Now, we were certainly thinking of our own radio observatory at or near Caltech with our own astronomy staff closely linked to it. The Carnegie Institution was thinking of it as possibly something near them. Remember, that's a sponsorship.
Right.
Because they wanted to expand, and whether they would have done it with government money or not only came up later when Merrill Tuve of Carnegie tried essentially to create an organization of half a dozen universities rather than let it go to AUI.
Mm-hmm.
Among the conferees was Wiesner, who was one of the greatest science politicians and was interested in the ionosphere, and fighting with him was a problem. And the other name I'm looking for is the man who was head of AUI, who in fact eventually won the battle for power.
Emerson?
No, he was just an employee, but there was a distinguished electrical engineer, physicist.
I know what you mean, I can't think of his
name. Yeah, he's dead, he died.
Anyway, you're saying that he came into the ascendancy, and that's why NRAO came under the auspices of AUI.
Exactly. But we had everybody who was anybody at the meeting, and...
So you were not directly involved then in the development of NRAO, although obviously you're very interested in
it. Well, I had six or seven hats from 1952 to I think 1956 or seven. I was on or chairman of the advisory panel for astronomy for the NSF.
Oh, I see.
And so I was pushing there, and I was pushing else on the outside. 49 to 52, chairman of astronomy advisory panel to ONR, NBS, and then 53 to 57 was, but I think I was actually in 52 already, the first year, on the Committee of Consultants on Astronomy and Radio Astronomy to the NSF, and the Mathematical and Physical and Engineering Sciences Divisional Committee to the NSF till 60. So I was an NSF advisor from the year it was formed in a tiny committee, which Bob McMath of Michigan started with Leo Goldberg, Martin Schwarzschild, myself, and Whitford, I think it was. Before there was any budget, I think they had $200,000 they had an astronomy committee.
Right.
And that's, in a sense, one of the reasons that astronomy bulked so large in capital funding was that we were really in on the ground floor. McMath was a friend of the head of the Bureau of the Budget, and sort of begged him to make sure that if there was any money for NSF, except for the director and his few assistants, there would be an astronomy committee. The fight was not always pleasant, and I wore too many hats.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted it here. I didn't want a national observatory. I wanted a good radio observatory in a university setting. The future of radio observatories in university settings is extremely dim now. But that's
20 years later.
20 years later. NRAO.
Was it a philosophical objection to a national observatory that you felt that it wouldn't have the excellence or that it would get too big and too unwieldy? Or what was it about it that did not appeal to you?
Shall we say I'll write a book about it someday if I can remember it. That is too big a question, really. It's clear that you're never going to spend an enormous fraction of the federal budget for basic research on astronomy unless you give up some degree of control. I think philosophically and practically my whole life in astronomy had been at centers of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
At Harvard, when I think it had invented astrophysics in the 30s and applied it to the stars rather than just mathematical fiction. Yerkes at, I think, its best, and then Caltech, I hope, at its best, and the observatories here. All of them privately supported, all of them believing almost in the principles of Bodden and Minkowski. Follow your nose where it wants to.
Mm-hmm.
And although I was a government advisor, from the year there was the first government committee in astronomy, the ONR thing, which I think had $80,000 to spend a year, I'd always felt that the universities were where good science could be done, and there was something deadly in government labs. And I must remind you of one thing. After World War II, there were many government laboratories, but they were in a state of complete crumbling. Anybody good who had been there had left when the war ended. They'd done their duty, and off they were.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very rough period for government laboratories and merit in government-sponsored research. I was an advisor also, for example, in the same period, to the U.S. Air Force, mm-hmm. Scientific Advisory Board of the U.S. Air Force. And they were sponsoring research, but and it may still be classified, but I can assure you it wasn't any good.
Yeah.
And the Army was the worst of all. It had a Fort Huachuca or something in Texas. It was the place where Army radar was supposed to be. It was a disaster area. Yeah. I'm sure all of that's libelous, but
yeah.
It was really, there was no real proof that the government could do what it now does. Give the power and give a regular budget. And in fact, of course, the case still remains to be proved, because it doesn't give a regular budget. It